Off the Ball Breakfast.
Well, you're not supposed to pull someone's hair.
But they have long hair. So, like, it's more likely to be pulled. Like, if Cameloon had a skin fade yesterday, he wasn't getting his hair pulled.
So it's
grow your hair if you're
the careful line of not blaming the victim here.
A little bit of victim blaming.
Why are you shoving his face?
Live every weekday morning from 7:30 on your smart speaker. Just ask Alexa to play OTB Sports Radio.
Off the Ball Daily.
Now, though, Rory, the heartache and triumph of golf's most human superstar, is a new biography that has been written by Alan Shipnuck, who I'm delighted to say is with us on the line. Alan, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
So, after the events of the last couple of days, the second edition of this book is surely in the works.
It definitely is, yes. Rory makes so much news so quickly, it's hard to keep up, but... You know, the 2025 Masters was just catharsis. It was just relief. It ended this long, long journey for Rory. This felt like joy, this one did. And so it's a wonderful achievement for him. I still think that the book holds up, but there will be a new chapter. There is no doubt.
When you read the book, Augusta is central to pretty much every chapter. You break it so that it's the story of a year and then it's the real stuff. It's the story of Rory's relationship with Augusta. Was that a big editorial decision for you, or is it pretty obvious that Rory McIlroy and Augusta is pretty much one of the most important relationships in his professional life?
Yeah, no question. You know, when he loses the Masters in 2011 and he blows that 4-shot lead and he's crying down in Amen Corner, that is really the most important moment of his golfing life, because then he spends the next 2 months rebuilding himself, as you know, mentally, physically, spiritually, and then he wins the U.S. Open by 8 strokes and launches his legend. And so that disappointment and then the breakthrough, you know, 14 years later, it has almost this epic, you know, mythical quality to it. And so Augusta was always going to loom very large in the Rory McIlroy story. And it's just inescapable. It gives, obviously, the book a great crescendo and kind of a happy ending that, honestly, Rory deserved.
To quote from the book, because this has been a talking point since Sunday with regards to Rory's preparation for Augusta. You write, in his decade-long quest to complete the Grand Slam, McIlroy had tried everything to peak for the Masters. Play the week before, rest the week before, arrive in Augusta early, arrive in Augusta late, play the course weeks ahead of time, skip the extra preparation. The one thing he had never done was treat November and December as if the Masters were imminent. And that's the key change ahead of the 2025 Masters. But I think that's quite prescient this week and in some of the criticism that's come out over the past 72 hours. Rory McIlroy had tried everything. I mean, putting the magnifying glass on his preparation ahead of this week is not necessarily a fair gauge in terms of why he was ahead of the field at the end of Sunday evening.
Well, it's a dumb argument, because any person in the field can go to Augusta National and play ahead of time. Any player can make those scouting trips. If you're a guest of a member, you can go unlimited times. If you show up by yourself, at some point, the lords of Augusta National might say, okay, that's enough. You've reached your limit. For a player like Rory, they're going to give him more leeway as the defending champion, as one of the greatest golfers of all time. But the fact remains, Rory's preparation should be celebrated. That's how much he cares. Like, he has the crown and the jewels. He's done everything you can do in this sport, and yet he still has that burning passion to win and to complete his destiny and be one of the greatest players of all time. So that people are somehow criticizing for going the extra mile to be overprepared is nonsense. Like, these are things to be celebrated. So it's a bad faith argument, but it does show that how much Rory cares, that he would make so many trips in this title defense to prepare himself and to keep trying to learn the nuances of this very, you know, tricky, crafty golf course. So I salute Rory. I mean, that is a difference maker between him and some other great talents, is they want to sit on their couch and Rory's willing to make that extra effort. And that's what a champion does.
There is also a full circle nature to this, as you outline in the book. Like, the history of Rory is detailed with a great level of depth. And we learn a lot about the people of Hollywood, the people behind that golf course, and the golf course itself, and the similarities between the golf course and Augusta National.
There's probably only one similarity, is that there's very sloping terrain, and there's a funny quote from one of the old timers at Hollywood Golf Club that, you know, it's often said you need to have one leg longer than the other to play here, because I went out and played Hollywood and it's built on the side of a hill. There's no flat lies, and that is the one thing it has in common with Augusta National, and that Rory McIlroy likes to win on both courses. But there is a little something to that, because, you know, Jordan Spieth has a great record at the Masters, and he's always said it unlocks sort of the athletic side of him as a golfer, because you never have a flat lie. You always have to manufacture shots, and it takes you out of your, you know, robotic swing mechanics, and it forces you to be creative. And so there is a validity to that, even though it's kind of cheeky to compare the very, very humble Hollywood Golf Club, working man's club, you know, but I think there's something to the fact that it allows Rory to access this childlike love of just of being creative, and that's a big part of him as a golfer.
You allude to the fact that as soon as Rory has his breakthrough, it becomes a rite of passage for a lot of writers to travel over the Atlantic, to go to Hollywood, to tell the Rory story of where he grew up, where he managed to cut his teeth in terms of becoming this sensational golfer. What do you learn when you write this book at this juncture? When there's a little bit more time and there's a lot of stuff that's already been written in the past, what are you learning that's new to you about Hollywood and Rory's upbringing?
Yeah, there's so much. I mean, every chapter of the book had revelations for me. I think a lot of fans kind of knew the broad strokes of Rory's journey, but it's getting into the details that's so much fun. And, you know, for American fans, we didn't know about Rory until he was already a few years into his professional career when he started playing over here. So his childhood, his amateur days, even his early years on the European tour, I learned a ton in the research and all the interviews, and I think a lot of fans will as well. And yes, every member of the Golf Writers Association of America has gone to Hollywood Golf Club, because it's a chance to go to and play all these great links courses on the Irish Island. And so it's kind of a joke how many guys have made that boondoggle. But of course, I did it too. I was there last year during the week of the Open. And it was I went down there on Saturday of the Open. It was fun just to hang out and drink with the members and play the golf course and really get a feel for the humility and of this place that's produced this great champion. And I went to Pedrinha in Spain, which is the hometown of Seve Ballesteros, and I went to his home club there, and it reminded me of that, just kind of a simple life, and the family and golf and some of those rituals are at the center of it for a lot of people in Hollywood and in Pedrinha. And there was a familiarity there, and it was sweet to kind of be a part of that, even if just for a day.
The humility piece is so important, and again, this is something that really fits into the imagery of last Sunday when you see Jerry and Rosie right there when Rory is making his acceptance speech on Sunday night. Their role in Rory's humility by their very existence is important, but also in terms of their own very deliberate ways in which they looked after the kid and which they tried to mold him into being a good person first and foremost while his golf star was rising.
It's part of the warm glow around these victories for Rory is that he so clearly loves his parents and that they're there for him. And you know, I knew that he came from a blue collar family and they had to sacrifice for him. And that's almost a cliche in sports. But when you get into the granular details, I mean, Jerry would get up at first thing in the morning, he'd go to this rugby club and he would clean the toilets and he would vacuum the hallways. And he was basically the janitor there and he'd get the place set up. And then he'd go over to Hollywood Golf Club and serve as a waiter and as a bartender until dinner time. And he'd rush home to have dinner with Rory and Rosie. And then he'd be back at the rugby club to serve as a bartender till midnight. I mean, this is a 16 to 18 hour day. And then as soon as he came home at midnight, Rosie would walk out the door and go work in this factory packing boxes. And, you know, there's a moment in the book where he says, like, why are we not like a normal family? Because his parents were never together. I mean, they really did sacrifice everything for him. And the fact that for all the success and all the material spoils, there is just this incredible bond that remains between them. And they have this gratitude that they did it, because so many families have tried to create a star in any sport, and it just doesn't work out for a variety of reasons. And they're one in a million. And the fact that they take so much joy in it, you know, there's a moment in Tiger Woods. It's the first time he won after he'd been married, and he goes back to the hotel room, and his then wife Elin, she's watching Tiger just pack his suitcase. There's no celebration. There's no joy. She says, "Aren't we gonna have a party?" And Tiger says, "No, this is just what I do." And it helps explain why everything went sideways for Tiger, because it became a job for him. It almost became drudgery. And there's so much joy in Rory's life around his golf and around his family. And I think that's part of why he can just keep going. And it keeps his feet on the ground, and it gives him something to play for that's larger than himself. Because, you know, golf is lonely, and that chase can feel empty if you're by yourself. But Rory has his parents. He has this whole group of friends. Of course, he has the entire Irish island now. He has all of Europe from his Ryder Cup heroics. It's like it's something bigger than himself. And he's sort of chasing this to fulfill this promise that of him as a player and to kind of complete his destiny in a way. I think having all these people in his life that he's so close to, it gives it more meaning for him. And I think that bodes really well for his longevity.
One of the things that really struck me as well is that when it comes to his dad, Jerry, it feels that he's got a really deep intelligence by knowing that he's not the smartest guy in the room. In terms of just keeping his ears open, like there's a really good piece in the book where it certainly seemed to me reading it, where he, when it came to like Rory's decision to go to college or not at that point in his career, and Jerry is leaning on the expertise of other people, both in the United States and here in Europe. And when somebody says to him, maybe it's not the right call for Rory to go to college at this point, Jerry's like, okay, I kind of thought so. He kind of just needed to confirm that with somebody. You also tell the story of him splashing out on equipment for Rory, which for a family earning what they were earning was a huge amount of the money they were making. But again, a smart investment, a smart decision, knowing that equipment can actually make you better relative to your field, especially when you've got the gifts that Rory does. And I think we kind of talk about the strategizing of Rory's career and the management of his star in his 20s. But I think he was managed in a very smart way throughout his entire life, particularly by his dad.
Yeah, and you know, Jerry's not a learned man, but he's very street smart. And you can say the same about Rory. You know, he dropped out of school at 15. I know he's always going to be self-conscious about that, but Rory has acquired these mentors, JP McManus, Dermot Desmond, you know, Jimmy Dunn. These are titans of the business and finance world. And he leans on them for counsel all the time. Not just in his business endeavors, but just in life. You know, they're older, they're wiser, they've seen and done it all. And again, that takes a certain humility to say, I don't know it all. And I'm going to collect these smart people and I'm going to listen to them. And that's probably a rare attribute in superstar athletes, to be honest. And so that's part of why, you know, Rory's sitting on this whole business empire of which people only know a little bit about. And I get into it in the book, and he's made many smart moves, but he's a good CEO. You know, Rory McIlroy Inc. now has 30 employees, and Rory is the de facto CEO, but he puts smart people around him and he lets them do their job and use their expertise, and he listens to them. And that, again, there's a lot of people in the business world who have trouble doing that. They micromanage and they don't empower the people around them. So yeah, there is a level of sophistication from the entire McIlroy clan that I think would be surprising to people. And they just look at their education level, where they came from, et cetera. But they're very crafty, and they've made many, many good decisions along the way.
And also when you compare Rory to some of his contemporaries, particularly in the United States, how quickly he realizes important things like the image of Rory. And I think he used the contrast with Dustin Johnson, who, you know, just naturally, just at that point in their career, just a more aesthetically pleasing looking man than Rory McIlroy was, with his curly hair and all that and the big Jumeirah logo on his head, that he was a more slick operation. He was a more slick billboard than Rory was. But Rory realizes that within a couple of years. And look, I think the image that Jumeirah had is actually quite an amazing sort of nostalgic one that we all remember from the early years of Rory, but he realized it needed to be sleeker, it needed to be different, and he was quite ruthless in the business decisions that he made in order to achieve that.
Yeah, and there were some hard lessons along the way. I mean, you mentioned Chubby Chandler earlier. That was not that acrimonious, but it came at a challenging moment in Rory's life and his career. The next agent, Connor Ridge of Horizon Sports, that was acrimonious. That wound up in the high court. And, you know, Rory had to write a check for 18 million quid. And so he made his mistakes and he had his controversies and there was some messiness in his business life. But again, he applied those lessons and he put the right people around him. And now, you know, Rory's had this core going back a decade with his manager, his caddy, and then you layer in the swing coach, who's a lifelong relationship, and his parents and all of it. So there's this very insular, like fiercely loyal tribe around Rory, and all they care about is best interest, and they're not in it for the glory. You know, Michael Bannon almost never does interviews. Harry Diamond never does interviews. These guys don't want to have a high profile in the media. They're not trying to get book deals and TV shows. Like, all they care about is helping Rory be the best he can be. And that's not easy to find those people. And many golfers before him have struggled with that. And so, you know, Rory again has organized his life in a very effective way. And he has the right people who all they care about is helping him access his genius and achieve things in this game. And so but that didn't happen by accident. It took work and it took trial and error and it took some messiness, but he's there now and you can see the positive effects.
Yeah. Like, to go back to the Tiger comparison, you describe him as Rory, that is, as wholesome, unproblematic, university liked and admired, when you sort of position this, and Rory being positioned as the anti-Tiger early in his career. To what extent has that changed over the last couple of years, particularly in this post-live world in which we now exist?
Yeah, that's part of why Rory is a good subject for biography, because he's complex and he's even a little contradictory and he's definitely become more polarizing into his mid-30s. You know, I'd say 5 years ago, he was universally beloved. He was kind of this cuddly character, and he's developed much pointier elbows, to use Paul McGinley's term. And he was a great statesman throughout this sort of battle for the soul of professional golf between the PGA Tour and LIV Golf. But he was also the leading troll, and he made it very personal. You know, he took a lot of shots at Greg Norman, at Phil Mickelson, sundry others involved with LIV Golf. And I think this battle elevated Rory in the eyes of many. You know, he became kind of the conscience of the sport, but he certainly lost some fans along the way too, the LIV loyalists and others who just felt like, why is he being so uppity? Why is he making this so personal? And so I don't think Rory has any regrets, but for sure he's become a little more of a controversial figure in the sport. And, you know, Rory's taken strong stances against the Ryder Cup, and then he's changed his mind. He's called the Olympics basically meaningless, and then he's changed his mind. And so he takes some flack for that. At the same time, I think it's a mostly admirable trait where he will say something from the heart in the moment and he means it. But then over time, he's presented new evidence, he has new experiences, and he says, you know what, I think I was wrong. And most people will just dig in and never admit that. It's hard for a public figure to put their hand up and say, I was wrong. But Rory does that, and I find it endearing. I'm sure some people find it maddening, but, you know, in this modern life, in this modern media climate, political climate, you know, people, they take one side of an issue and they defend it to the death. And I think it's admirable that Rory will say, you know what, I've changed my mind. So he's definitely a complex person, and that's what makes him interesting. You know, if you look at Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, they're all the same person. You know, they grew up in affluence at these private golf clubs. They went to American colleges. They married their college sweetheart. They've had the same people around them their whole life as agents and swing coaches and caddies. And it's just a much smaller, more boring life. You know, Rory has lived large. He has chewed the scenery, as they say in Hollywood. And it just makes it more compelling. People are more invested in his story because they've been through these ups and downs. And it obviously makes him a better subject for a book. So, he's just a compelling character. There's no way around that.
How does he feel about this book?
So that's been a little bit of a journey. You know, Rory is used to having control in every aspect of his life. And when I approached him about this book and asked if he'd sit for interviews, like, he knew he'd have no control over the book. And that's deeply unsettling for him, because there's this power dynamic he's used to where he has all the power. And he had no leverage over me in this book. I was just going to write the book I wanted to write. And so he distanced himself from the project. I think it got into his head at a certain point. This is all in the first chapter of the book. We had this animated discussion, you could say, at the US Open at Oakmont. But there is a happy ending, because when Rory came to Pebble Beach, that I live nearby, and this is in February, 2 months ago, I gave him an early copy of the book. And I said, you know, I wouldn't do this if I thought you were going to hate it. Like, if you can read it with an open mind, you'll see it's a feel-good story. It's written with a lot of affection. And that he got that. That was on Tuesday of Pebble Beach week. On, you know, fast forward to Sunday night, tournament's over. I've stayed in the press room to write my story. I'm walking to my car. It's dark. And I bumped into Rory and Harry. They were walking into the tap room, the kind of this famous bar restaurant at Pebble Beach. And I just get a meal or whatever. And we had a laugh. Like, of all the people you're going to run to on a dark, you know, rainy night in Pebble Beach, it had to be me. But he said he'd started reading the book and he liked it and it made him laugh. And, you know, that first chapter has all the spiciness with our exchange at Oakmont. And so I think I'm in a good place with Rory. And on a personal level, that's nice. Professionally, I don't really care. Like, I didn't write the book for him. I write it for the golf fans. I write it for the people at home. Like, that's the audience that I sort of have this sacred relationship with. And so I was always going to write the book I wanted to write. But the fact that Rory is good with it, it helps turn the temperature down a little bit. You know, my last two books on Phil Mickelson biography and about this battle between the tours were a little overheated, a little controversial. I'm glad this is more of a feel good tale.
Yeah.
So it was nice that we had that interaction, I will say.
You might need a new edition of Live and Let Die as well at this point. What can you tell us, Alan, about what's going down in New York this week? An emergency meeting has been called between all the big players
and Mexico. Yeah, and Mexico City. I mean, I've been calling and texting a lot of people trying to get information. I'm thinking about just flying to Mexico City and just see what I'm sniffing around, because it's a very chaotic, fast moving situation. It sounds like, for sure, this has been confirmed. People aren't getting paid right now. The players, the support staff, whether that's a temporary glitch, or whether this is the beginning of the end, we're going to find out in the next days and weeks, but there is some tumult. There is, and you know, an agent who's close to all this told me that Yasir Al-Rumayyan might want to, you know, use a force majeure clause. You know, that's basically, you can get out of a contract if there's an act of God, essentially. And a regional war that's happening in Iran that's affecting all the Gulf states, arguably that would apply. And so if he has a mandate from his boss to shut it down, like, no more vanity projects, we're not going to waste any more billions of dollars on things that are non-essential to the state right now in this very tumultuous moment, maybe this gave Yasir the wiggle room, or what he thinks is the political cover, to try and pull the plug. But it could also just be it's a messy situation over there and the money's not flowing and it'll get resolved. We're going to find out, but things are afoot. You can say that with some certainty. What it means in the short, medium, and long term for LIV Golf, that's TBD, but it's going to come to a head here soon.
How long have people gone without getting paid?
Sounds like this is a recent thing as of this tournament in Mexico City and this week. So again, if the international banking system is collapsing because of the war and they just need a little more time to straighten it out, that could be a harmless explanation. But the fact that there's been silence from LIV Golf and they've canceled all the press conferences this week and no one's returning calls, like, everyone's trying to figure it out in real time, including the people on LIV Golf.
Yeah. Yeah, it says a lot. Just one last thing, Alan, before I let you go. In terms of what this week does to change the standing of Rory McIlroy in terms of the game's all-time greats, you've written that Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Bobby Jones, Bob Hogan and Walter Hagen are your top five in that order. And then the next tier would have comprised of Gary Player, Gene Sarazen, Arnold Palmer, Sam Snead, Tom Watson and Harry Vardon. McIlroy gets in that company as a result of getting to number six last Sunday. Does he surpass many of them?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about this. That was written before Rory went back to back, and he's every time he wins a major, every time he does something massive in the game, he's moving up the list. So in my mind, and I put a lot of thought in this actually last night, like I've got him number nine all time now. I think he's surpassed Sarazen. I think he's surpassed Vardin. You know, he's right there. Next up on the list would be Palmer, would be Watson, would be Player. Like, the weight of the career Grand Slam is massive. Becoming only the fourth man to win at Augusta back-to-back is huge. And then you layer in these other things, you know, three money titles in the U.S., seven in Europe. Like, that is an incredible body of work. He's been on six winning Ryder Cup teams. He's probably going to go down as the winningest player in the history of Ryder Cup, both individual and team. You can't underrate that. The fact that Rory's won all over the world, and you know, it's tough to compare eras, right? Like, Ben Hogan didn't have a chance to play globally, so you have to account for these things. You can only dominate the era that you're in, but Rory's now been doing it for 15 years, and his body of work just becomes more and more massive. And so, yeah, he is in very, very rarefied air. And I mean, there's a cute bit in the book where, because I ask people, you know, what is Rory chasing? And Padraig Harrington says to me, oh, I know, because I asked him on his wedding night and he'd had a few glasses of wine. And you know, Rory said, you know, nine majors was the number he had in his head. How he got there, I don't know, but that's what Rory was thinking. And so he's two thirds of the way there. I mean, if Rory gets to nine, he's top five player of all time, without question. And so, you know, he cares about his place in golf history and he cares about his legacy and he wants the crown jewels. He wants to win an Open at St. Andrews. He wants to win a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. You know, he wants to win an Open at Portrush. There's certain venues, there's certain accomplishments that just mean more. And Rory knows that and he's chasing them. So I think a lot of his best golf is still in front of him. And it's really fun to think about that. We're all going to be witnesses to this. You know, this career's already been wondrous, and there's still a whole nother act to come. So, that's Rory was put on this earth to thrill golf fans, and I think he understands the assignment. It's a fun time to be watching golf, writing about golf, consuming golf.
It definitely is. The book in question is Rory, The Heartache and Triumph of Golf's Most Human Superstar. The author who you've been listening to for the last half an hour is Alan Shipnuck. Alan, best of luck with Version 2 of the book, and good luck going down to Mexico City if that's where you end up this week. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Cheers. We'll take a quick break.
This week on News Talk is Wish Week in partnership with Make-A-Wish Ireland.
A week when we come together to help bring hope, strength and happiness to the lives of children with critical medical conditions.
Visit makeawish.ie.
Because every wish counts.
Off the Ball, daily.